For a day's bread ration, or simply for the fun of it, the girls boasted that they could satisfy an entire team of tree fellers. One need not have grown up in the gulag to become transformed by it. When World War II came, strict new regulations came with it. A ukaz was issued which provided that any worker who left his job in a war plant, no matter for what reasons, was subject to from 6 to 8 years of imprisonment. Hundreds of young girls between the ages of 18 and 20 were sent to Kalima for running away to their villages because they could no longer endure the starvation in the cities where they had been forced to work. Some had only gone back home for a few days to visit a sick mother, but the factory manager would not give them any days off, and when they returned, they were arrested. They came as adolescents and were instantly transformed by Kalima into full-fledged prostitutes. Much like being an NKVD head, running the gulag was a powerful but personally very dangerous position. Gulag chief Fyodor Eichmanns was shot in 1938, and his two successors both shot one after another in 1939. All this fed into the mentality of, if only Stalin knew. True believers in the communist system explained away their own personal imprisonment as a plot by the local NKVD, the very cunning work of foreign intelligence services, or the ubiquitous invisible wreckers. Others better understood the consequences of a system built on destroying such bourgeois ideas as individualism, insisting that the repressions are a historical necessity for the development of our society. Escape was impossible because there was simply nowhere to go in the Arctic wilderness. For a civilian to help an escapee would be a life-threatening risk in a region so unfitted to habitation to begin with. Herlin Grudzinski discusses the story of one man who managed to get out of his gulag, finally finding a nearby village after a week of wandering and then collapsing inside of the first hut that he found. The camp chief had reportedly never even bothered to send out a search team, knowing that the man would either die in the forest or come back to the camp. Indeed, the peasants drove him back to the camp, and there the guards took him to the internal prison, where, still unconscious, he was beaten so cruelly that for 3 months he was near death, and even after his life had been saved, he had to remain in the hospital for another 2 months. The escapee survived only in order to serve as a living testament to the hopelessness of the prisoner's situations. "You can't escape from the camp, my friends," he repeatedly warned his fellows. "Freedom isn't for us. We're chained to this place for the rest of our lives, even though we aren't wearing chains. We can escape, we can wander about, but in the end, we'll come back. That's our fate, our cursed fate." Indeed, suicide wasn't even an option, but not because it wasn't tempting. "The chief reason for the relatively low rate of suicide," explained one captive, "is the fact that prisoners are never alone." The workload was as varied as industry could be. The Guide to the System of Corrective Labor Camps in the USSR recounts the existence of camps organized around gold mines, coal mines, nickel mines, highway and railway construction, arms factories, chemical factories, metal processing plants, electricity plants, the building of airports, apartment blocks, sewage systems, the digging of peat, the cutting of trees, and the canning of fish. Picture albums demonstrate the production of everything up to and including the proverbial kitchen sink, including mines, missiles, and other army equipment, car parts, door locks, buttons, logs floating down rivers, wooden furniture, including chairs, cabinets, telephone boxes, and barrels, shoes, baskets, and textiles with samples attached, rugs, leather, fur hats, sheepskin coats, glass cups, lamps, and jars, soap and candles, even toys, wooden tanks, tiny windmills, and mechanical rabbits playing drums. It is not an exaggeration to say that the economy of the Soviet Union was heavily predicated on, if not entirely based on, the forced labor of hundreds of thousands of innocent people being kept imprisoned in the camps of the Gulag. It only took a geological discovery in a remote region to launch a ship of thousands of prisoners in icy storms in the spring of 1940. When they landed, they then had to build their new prisons while the guards stood by with bayonets. When a hurricane came, the guards and prisoners were washed away alike, only leaving those who had managed to tie themselves to the posts that had been put up. Only a few hundred eventually managed to return to Magadan a year later, where the doctors proceeded to remove those body parts that had been taken by frostbite. As the prisoner nurse later wrote, "Not one failed to pay for his life with frozen hands or feet, frozen ears, nose, or cheeks." Contact with the outside world was mixed at best. Some prisoners would be allowed visits with family members a couple of times a year, but even that was predicated on the family knowing where the captive had been taken. Worse, maintaining contact with someone convicted of being a counter-revolutionary or a kulak was very risky behavior. Some wives had the decency to visit in order to tell their spouses to their face that they had decided to divorce, and they could hardly be blamed for it. Letters and packages sent into and out of the camps were subject to inspection by guards in a country where even someone with impeccable class consciousness could expect to have their mail read by the authorities, and where the postal service hardly operated with any semblance of efficiency. Food and gifts were prime for plunder by the guards, whereas letters piled up in stacks of thousands by guards who could not be bothered to distribute them. Families would assume the worst when their letters would be unreplied to, while prisoners would assume that they had been disowned when they had no contact from their loved ones. Even for the administrators themselves, basic stationery and writing implements were hardly ubiquitous. A prisoner who possessed such items could easily be construed as sending secret missives against the authorities. For every captive whose life was saved by a parcel of food sent from home that somehow got past the guards. It took 3 years in one critical case. There were many more whose starvation or malnutrition could have been prevented if they simply got what had been mailed to them. The slave camps of the Nazis and President Truman's victory over them is widely remembered today, but the Gulag and Henry Wallace are largely forgotten. Though the level of appreciation for Truman has increased over the decades, during his 1948 election campaign, he was popularly regarded as a bit of a screw-up who lucked his way into the presidency. "We're just mild about Harry" was the slogan for the day, and it was a given that after four Democrat terms in the White House, the next president would be another New York governor, Republican Thomas Dewey. Truman's 1948 upset election victory was captured by the famous photo of him holding up the mistaken Chicago Daily Tribune headline reading, "Dewey defeats Truman." What is less known is that Truman would later go on to win the record for the lowest ever approval rating for a president as recorded by Gallup, hitting a shocking 22%, lower than even Nixon would ever get. But there were two other major candidates running in 1948, Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond and, reviving the banner of the Progressive Party, Henry Wallace. A darling of the left, Wallace played to independents and Democrats who were disaffected by Truman. He scored some major endorsements, including architect Frank Lloyd Wright, inspiration for the protagonist of The Fountainhead, NAACP founder W.B. Du Bois, and Harold and the Purple Crayon creator Crockett Johnson. Albert Einstein was also a supporter of Wallace's, while on the other hand, filmmaker Orson Welles refused to have anything to do with him. Welles regarded him as a prisoner of the Communist Party, who would never do anything to upset them. "I was very, very passionately against him," Wells said. "The left thought I was a real traitor." As late as 1948, long after World War II had ended, Wallace's warmth towards Stalinism was not a deal breaker for the influencers, but denouncing Wallace was. The Wallace campaign did a fair amount of work to allow President Truman to position himself as the common sense centrist he is widely remembered as today. Wallace finished fourth with a little over 1 million votes and 2.4% of the vote total, a significantly smaller vote share than socialist Eugene V. Debs had received when he had run for the presidency in 1920 while incarcerated. As time went on, information came out from prisoners who had been there when Vice President Wallace had visited Magadan. One schoolboy at the time remembered Wallace's visit vividly because the most unusual thing was that suddenly the windows of the shops were full of Soviet foodstuffs. God knows where this stuff came from. After Wallace left, the products of course vanished as quickly as they had appeared. In 1951, Wallace's reputation took another hit when Regnery published Eleanor Lipper's memoir of life in the Gulag, 11 years in Soviet prison camps. Lipper had been a Swiss national before being caught in the Gulag's web, and as a result was one of the very few people released from the camps who were later allowed to leave the Soviet Union. The book specifically discussed what conditions were like at Magadan, where Lipper spent a total of 8 years, including during Wallace's trip. It was yet another piece of evidence that Wallace had been utterly played for a fool by the Soviets. "Every prisoner who was there at the time owes Mr. Wallace a debt of gratitude," she scoffed, "for it was owing to his visit that for the first and last time the prisoners had three successive holidays." In order to ensure that he never saw a single prisoner, none of them were allowed to leave the camp, and to make certain he couldn't accidentally see them in the yard, movies were shown to the prisoners from morning until night for 3 days. Reading Wallace's friendly words about Ivan Nikishov, a key official in Magadan, Lipper wrote that it is too bad that Wallace never saw him gambling around on one of his drunken rages around the prison camps, raining filthy savage languages upon the heads of the exhausted starving prisoners, having them locked up in solitary confinement for no offense whatsoever, and sending them into the gold mines to work 14 and 16 hours a day at no matter what human cost. Would these words bear repetition when the mounds of frozen corpses under the snow are one day disinterred to testify what the Soviet Union really is? She demanded of the rosy claims of Wallace and his fellow travelers. It was in September 1952, in what would have been the last months of Wallace's second term as president, that Wallace finally admitted that he had been fooled by Stalin and his men. "I had not the slightest idea when I visited Magadan that this far north Pacific port, center of a vast subarctic goldfield, was also the center for administering the labor of both criminals and those suspected of political disloyalty," Wallace wrote. "Nothing I saw at Magadan or anywhere else in Soviet Asia suggested slave labor. True, I had heard that many kulaks who had their farms taken from them in the early 30s had been sent to Siberia, but I had not the slightest idea that there were many slave labor camps in Siberia in 1944, and that of these, the most notorious was Magadan." By 1952, there remained apologists for the USSR in the West, but far fewer flat-out advocates. As Wallace himself concluded, "More and more, I am convinced that Russian communism, in its total disregard of truth, in its fanaticism, its intolerance, and its resolute denial of God and religion, is something utterly evil." By this point, Robert Hannigan, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who had been so instrumental in replacing FDR's running mate in 1944, had passed away at the very early age of 46. His St. Louis tombstone is simply inscribed Robert Emmett Hannigan, June 30, 1903, October 6, 1949. Unlike at the convention, his wishes were not honored. Hannigan had quipped that he wanted his tombstone to read, "Here lies the man who stopped Henry Wallace from becoming president of the United States." Chapter 9, Waiting for the Doorbell to Ring. Hitler and the Nazis were defeated in 1945. It was the Russians who had reached his bunker first, proudly raising the hammer and sickle flag of the Soviet Union over the Reichstag as well. Whereas the United States had lost a bit over 400,000 men in World War II, the USSR lost somewhere between 8 and 12 million, in addition to a similar number of civilians. Further, Stalin sent many Russian ex-POWs to the Gulag upon their return to the USSR, both as punishment for having been captured and to isolate their knowledge about the outside world from the rest of the population. After World War II was won, dominion over Eastern Europe was largely ceded to the Soviet Union by the Western powers. All the land that Lenin had surrendered to Germany under the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk had been regained by Stalin. Bulgaria, Poland, Hungary, and Romania all had governments installed that answered to Moscow. The three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, fared even worse, losing their status as nations and becoming incorporated into the USSR as new Soviet Socialist Republics. No one knew what to do with the Japanese colony of Korea, so they just drew a line down the middle in order to form a communist North and a capitalist South. In Churchill's March 5th, 1946 words, "An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe: Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere, and all are subject in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and, in many cases, increasing measure of control from Moscow." The Cold War had begun. For a brief period, the United States had been the world's only nuclear power, but aspiring of Stalinists and fellow ideologues in various American classified agencies delivered the bomb to the Soviet Union by the end of the 1940s. By 1948, Czechoslovakia would also become taken over by a Soviet-led coup. The Cold War turned violent, with each half of Korea declaring itself the rightful government of the entire country. This led to the Korean War, where the United States and the newfound United Nations joined the forces of South Korea against the North Koreans with their Soviet allies, with now communist China also lending a hand. The war effectively ended in a draw, and the Korean people paid the price with the utter decimation of their country. Alongside Stalin through all this was the last and perhaps most malevolent of his many accomplices, Lavrenty Beria. Beria is not as widely remembered as that of high-ranking Nazis like Joseph Goebbels, Heinrich Himmler, or Rudolf Hess. The thing he is most remembered for is his infamous quote, "Show me the man, and I'll show you the crime." This wasn't some throwaway line either. As the third and last of Stalin's NKVD leaders, Beria was in charge of the secret police and expanding the Gulag, with all that that entailed. "Let me have one night with him, and I'll have him confessing he's the King of England," he bragged about one of his many captives. As one anecdote put it, one nasty morning, Comrade Stalin discovered that his favorite pipe was missing. Naturally, he called in his henchman Lavrenty Beria and instructed him to find the pipe. A few hours later, Stalin found it in his desk and called it the search. "But Comrade Stalin," stammered Beria, "five suspects have already confessed to stealing it." While Beria knew what sort of stress his work to get confessions out of the accused, he was also well aware of the limited efficacy of such methods. As he eventually admitted, "A person that's beaten will give the kind of confession that the interrogating agents want, will admit that he's an English or American spy or whatever we want, but it will never be possible to know the truth this way." This, of course, did not deter Beria or his men in the slightest. "When we Bolsheviks want to get something done," he once said, "we close our eyes to everything else." He was uniquely suited to run the secret police, a being of pure ruthlessness. Beria is a man for whom it costs nothing to kill his best friend if that best friend said something bad about Beria, noted one of his subordinates. It is clear why he got along so well with Stalin. In some limited respects, Beria was less of a butcher than his predecessors. When he took over from Yezhov in 1938, the worst of the Great Terror receded and the number of victims caught began to decrease. Yet this mitigation of the wholesale assault on the populace was in contrast to the personal depravity that Beria himself visited on so many men, women, and children who fell under his command. The vegetarian had no qualms about inflicting enormous suffering on human beings and even relished the opportunity. His coup de grace might have been getting an agent past security and, after several failed attempts, having Trotsky successfully assassinated via an ice pick to the head in his Mexico City home in 1940. If "Show me the man" could be viewed as Barry's professional slogan, his personal one could be illustrated by his response to Tatiana Okunevskaya. Okunevskaya was a popular actress, and Barry invited her to perform for the Politburo. When she accepted the invitation, he instead took her to a private home where he proceeded to try to get her drunk. Then Barry undressed and began to seduce her. To further entice her, he promised to free both her father and her grandfather from prison. "Scream or not, it doesn't matter," he told her. After he had his way with her and let her go, he nevertheless had her arrested and sent to Siberia. Nor did Barry keep his word about her family, because he couldn't. Both Okunevskaya's father and grandfather had already been executed. The unfortunate actress was not alone, for Beria was one of the worst sexual predators of all time. Beria had his men drive him around Moscow looking for women to pick up. Resistance from them would lead to extreme consequences, though compliance was not often a better option. 50 years after Beria's death, they were still finding the remains of his victims on the grounds of his former home. With a bureaucrat's obsessive attention to detail, both Beria and his bodyguard kept records of all the women that he engaged with. There does remain some dispute as to whether his sexual predations reached literal children or if he contented himself with mere teenagers. Stalin was quite aware of Beria's predilections. The man who had an entire country living in fear of him was still concerned about what Beria was capable of. When Stalin learned his daughter was at Beria's house, he called her in a panic and told her to leave right away. Notably, Stalin was more than happy to look the other way so long as Beria was performing his job to Stalin's satisfaction. This fit in with Stalin's broader perspective on the utility of sexual assault. Stalin made this point explicitly when privately faced with criticism of the Red Army's transgressions as it made its way west toward Berlin. Do you see what a complicated thing is a man's soul, a man's psyche? Well then, imagine a man who has fought from Stalingrad to Belgrade, over thousands of kilometers of his own devastated land, across the dead bodies of his comrades and dearest ones. How can such a man react normally? And what is so awful in his having fun with a woman after such horrors? When Stalin wasn't looking the other way regarding the Red Army's rapes, he was actively engaging it to perform mass murder. After he had invaded Poland in 1939, Stalin was stuck with tens of thousands of Polish prisoners of war that included many of the Polish intellectual elite. This had the potential to be a new anti-Soviet power center, which therefore had the potential to be a threat to Stalin's power. Beria, Stalin, and other top Soviet officials had a frank discussion about just what was to be done with the Polish captives. After much blunt talk came the decision: execution. Matters looked very different 2 years later. Stalin was incredulous when Hitler broke their pact and invaded the Soviet Union under Operation Barbarossa. The Red Army desperately awaited instruction from the Kremlin for days as Stalin went missing, unable to believe what the reports were telling him from the front. The Nazis made massive advances and preventable ones. Worse, Stalin's purges had wiped out most of Russia's best and brightest military leaders just a few years prior. "Everything's lost," a dejected Stalin said. "Lenin left us a great legacy, but we, his heirs, have shitted out our asses." As the Nazis worked their way east, they uncovered mass graves in Russia's cotton forest. It was there where Beria's men had left the remains of all the massacred Polish prisoners of war. It was a major international embarrassment for Stalin, and Russian claims that the dead were victims of the Nazis were met with great skepticism. The cotton massacre would be used for decades as evidence of the basic inhumanity underlying Stalin's regime. Though Stalin's relationship with Hitler vacillated between rivals to non-aggressors to co-conspirators against Poland to outright foes, there was one group that the two men both despised: Jews. Stalin's anti-Semitism was heavily informed by a couple of things. To begin with, Russia had historically been one of the most anti-Semitic countries on earth, both de facto and de jure. The promise of not only equality but mere safety in one's home drew a large percentage of Jews towards socialism both in Russia and abroad. This cultural tendency was compounded in Stalin by his personal hatred toward Trotsky. When Stalin met with Churchill and FDR at Yalta to plan against Hitler, he still found time to rant to the president about how Jews were parasites. Stalin's comments were dutifully censored from the official published version of the conversation. As historian Louis Rappaport pointed out, in the spirit of the Stalin-Hitler pact, all Soviet organs deliberately remained silent about the genocidal slaughtering of the Jews by the Nazi conquerors of Poland between September 1939 and June 1941, when the Nazis invaded the USSR. The silence continued even after Hitler invaded his former partner's empire. Stalin thus paved the way for the extermination of 1.5 million unsuspecting Jews in White Russia and the Ukraine. Any references to mass killings by the Third Reich were discussed in the Soviet press as simply targeting Poles or Ukrainians. The Nazis themselves were understandably baffled by Jewish obliviousness regarding Hitler's intentions in the western part of the Soviet Union. "The Jews are strikingly ill-informed about our attitude towards them and about the treatment Jews are receiving in Germany or Warsaw," said one Nazi report. "Although they do not expect to be granted equal rights with the Russians under the German administration, they do believe that we will let them alone if they apply themselves diligently to their work." When the Germans invaded the Ukrainian town of Korostia, the Jewish population accordingly greeted them with food as a welcome. No family, even his own, was safe from Stalin's modern pogrom. When Stalin's son Yasha was captured by Hitler's men, Stalin had Yasha's Jewish wife arrested as a plotter and thereby left his 3-year-old granddaughter without parents. Abandoned by his father, Yasha killed himself a few months later. And when Stalin's daughter later fell in love with a Jewish screenwriter, Stalin had the man arrested as a British spy before slapping the hell out of her for good measure. "Such a war going on, and she's busy the whole time fucking," he screamed at her, despite the fact that she had only shared kisses with her crush. As the war proceeded, any Jews in the Soviet Union who felt the need to organize came under great suspicion. Arrests of prominent Jewish writers and activists with international reputations could not simply be explained away easily. The Polish ambassador to the USSR demanded the release of the Bund, Poland's strongest and largest Jewish